I'm Brandon Bartnick, and this is the Future of Mobility Podcast.
The Future of Mobility Podcast is focused on the pursuit of safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation of goods and people. Given the critical nature of the world's climate and energy needs, these topics have never been more important, and they're certainly important to me. So, this podcast is a weekly interview series in which I learn from and put the spotlight on the people helping to develop and implement the technology required to move us forward. Who am I? As mentioned, my name is Brandon Bartnick, and I'm an engineer who realized that making a positive impact is the most important thing to me, both through this podcast and my career in the industry. If you're passionate about any of the topics I cover here, please feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to connect. Also, if you hear anything you like, please consider sharing the Future Mobility with a friend or colleague. This podcast is brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. Technology innovation is great, but it doesn't mean anything if we can't bring our impactful products to life, which means we have to build them. And unfortunately, that's easier said than done, especially for startups and evolving companies that need a reliable option for low-volume builds. That's where we come in. Edison is your turnkey manufacturing partner, specializing in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you need a trusted manufacturing partner, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to reach out to me directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or by visiting my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Now to this week's episode. Today I'm joined by Olaf Sakris. Olaf is general partner at Red Blue Capital, which is a global venture capital firm investing in leading mobility startups. He's also partner at Many Mobility before starting Red Blue. And really an interesting discussion here. And Olaf has written this mobility disruption framework, which you can find. There's a link you can find for free in the show notes. And really interesting perspective on how we should think about creating the future of mobility, the role of mobility and transportation within our society, and how we should think about both building effective systems in places where we get to start from scratch, but then also the question of in places that are more developed, how should we think about disrupting what is existing and all the challenges with the existing framework. I learned a ton here. I'll leave the intro short here. Please enjoy the conversation with Olaf Sakris. Today I'm joined by Olaf Sakris. Olaf, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this discussion. I think you have put a lot of thought into kind of the core questions that I'm trying to solve on this podcast and have some unique perspectives that are valuable. So, but maybe if you wouldn't mind real quick giving a kind of an intro. So what are you doing and kind of would you want to introduce kind of your background and where we are, maybe spend a minute or two?
Yeah, so I'm looking at this world from the perspective of an investor. I invest early stage into mobility startups. I specialize in investing in one vertical, which is more an exception than a rule in VC. Most VCs are generalists, which means they're looking at a lot of different kinds of companies and kind of learning a lot about them in each case. I think there's a big advantage to specializing. There are two kind of core advantages. The one is you understand the space and the companies that you're looking at quicker and better. You have a broader set of frameworks to plug things into. And B, you've got a network of relationships that can be very helpful to the founders that you're looking at or can be useful to you in understanding the technology better and deciding whether this is something that's going to work. So that's kind of my approach to investing. I've been investing in mobility for about a decade now. I helped form a VC called Maniv Mobility and then left in 21 to start my own firm called Red Blue.
Cool. And what within that specialization, where do you draw the bounds of what you're focusing on?
Yeah, so I think those two things are kind of the lens for drawing the bounds. So I could delineate things that are like harder to invest in and easier to invest in. Like drones, I've been a little bit more reticent to look at, and space, I think, is a little bit further out there. I've done a lot more in logistics recently than I did before, but it's a bit of a moving target. And I think the way that can kind of be justified or explained is that my network over time grows and changes. And so there's an expanding set of relationships in these new areas. My base of knowledge and my team's knowledge kind of changes over time. And so we can make better decisions on certain things as we learn better about that space. And then also what the opportunity set is constantly changing. When they started out, autonomous vehicles were like really, really hot. And there was a bunch of stuff to invest in around sensors and compute, et cetera, going into these vehicles, as well as the companies that were getting formed like Cruise. And then at some point that stopped being a great thing to invest in because all the companies had been well-funded and consolidated, and then kind of went on this like slower, you know, pathway, and definitely less investable pathway. And other things came into focus, micromobility, you know, new vehicle OEMs, et cetera, et cetera. It's wave after wave of different thing. And so as these waves break, we're adapting to it, but the sector focus is still a benefit throughout.
Cool. And then we might come back to kind of the investing thesis and how you think about stuff. But I think the I'd be really interested to dive into the worldview, for lack of a better term, and book you've written and how you think about things. And so maybe the starting point here is at least my attempt to define what I'm trying to do here with Future Mobility Podcast. I've put the bounds around safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation, which I call transportation, movement of goods and people. So how do you move, how do we collectively move goods and people in a way that provides some enrichment and fulfillment to people, allow them to do the things that they want with their life without hurting themselves, without hurting others, without having a negative impact on others today and in the future? That's kind of loosely how I've defined the objective. Maybe the first question is, like, when you think about the purpose of mobility, the purpose of transportation, what do you think we're actually talking about here?
I think it's similar to blood in the body. Like the purpose of blood in the body is to allow everything else in the body to basically survive and thrive. And similarly, transportation is like the connective layer that allows cities to function. Cities are kind of the engines of economic growth. If you think of like where the American economy is concentrated and where most of the population has moved to, it's all to urban centers. Over time, and especially the coasts. And so the degree to which people are connected also is the degree to which you have, you know, economic thriving. It's a million different stories, or millions of different stories, each day, the transportation kind of piece of the equation. It's kids going to this school versus that school and being able to get there, and, you know, their parents going to work, and goods arriving at restaurants, and all these different things that are just like building blocks for an economy, and then a global supply chain that moves goods to allow manufacturing and production. So there's lots of different layers to it. But I think it's quite obvious as you kind of see it as a kind of distinct layer in and of itself, that if this thing works better versus whether it works worse, if it works better, that's a good thing. And if it works worse, that's a bad thing. And I think your thesis is coming from a key insight, which is it's not working so great. Like, it could work a lot better. There are all these things that are really messed up that we kind of tolerate, but maybe we shouldn't. You know, 40,000 Americans, the youngest for the most part, I mean, this is like the leading cause of death for young people, are dying in car crashes. They don't need to. Like, it doesn't have to be this way. And beyond that, a lot of our time on a day-to-day basis is wasted in traffic. And that's just kind of dead time. Nobody likes it. It's stressful. It sucks. The fact that people get so enraged that they crash each other's cars, their cars into other people's cars during this time is like an indication that this is not leading to human thriving. There's a whole lot of different layers of like how our transportation system is really not great. And then in centers like New York, you know, the transit system, I mean, it's the most functional transit system in the U.S. in some sense. Like, it's actually more than half of people use transit rather than owning cars in New York, unlike every other city. But it's also way more broken than it needs to be. You go to London or many other cities, especially in East Asia, and you've got a completely different experience of a transit system, even though the density of New York can sustain and support a better system. So I think there are lots of ways in which the system that currently exists today is A, essential, but B, underperforming, especially in the United States. And there's ways in which technology and innovation and reimagining certain things can lead to much better outcomes. And I think being able to think about what is possible also allows you to reframe what is happening today more clearly.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's an interesting spot to go next. So the I'm guilty of this, but I think one of the main flaws generally is you come into, you look at this ecosystem and you see a lot of private use vehicles, a lot of cars in the U.S. You see some, whether it's taxis or bus or different means of transportation alongside that. And when you ask the question, and what my first thesis when I started this podcast is like, how do we make cars safer and more sustainable? How do we improve the propulsion system? How we make vehicles lighter? How do we prevent accidents with either with advanced driver assist and or autonomy? And so my first question is, how do you make incremental improvement to the existing means of transportation? I no longer believe that that's close to the most important question. I now think it's, well, how do we drive towards outcomes that, like, what are the key functions that we need to solve, and how do we drive towards outcomes that actually allow that? And yes, the car is probably part of that solution, but there's a lot more that goes into that solution than simply making a safer and more sustainable vehicle on a per mile basis. So I think the thing that you hinted there at the end would be interesting. Like when you look at what is possible here, what can good look like within a transportation ecosystem?
Yeah, I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent and talk about weight loss drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic, which is the same drug, but for different applications. And they've obviously been big news recently. And some of the conversations around these drugs is like, yeah, but why don't we fix the food supply? Because the reality is, and you talked about owning a car and being guilty in some way. I think the reality is, if you live in America and you don't own a car, most of America, you don't own a car, you're kind of like doing the dumb thing. Like your whole system is built around an expectation that you have a car. And the reason you wouldn't own a car is because you can't afford one. And then you kind of closed out of, you know, a lot of economic mobility as a result of the way the system is structured. So you're very much within an ecosystem or system that expects a certain way of working. And the system is good in some ways, like, you know, most American cities function decently well with the current transportation system. But, you know, I think a little bit like the obesity problem, like you have to first see that there's, you know, a big problem with the way the system has kind of these massive negative externalities in order to then be like, okay, we actually need to be thinking about ways this could be different and could be better. And the negative externalities start with the fact that cars are only utilized about 4 or 5% of the time. They're the second most expensive things most people own, and that many people can't afford to own them, and then they're locked out of the system. So it's not leading to equal outcomes, or you know, it creates this economic bifurcation, which has become more acute in the United States. Then beyond that, cities are structured around cars, and so because cars are low throughput and require a lot of space, you get these very spread out cities with parking mandates that make it convenient to use a car, but actually transfer the cost of car ownership to the kind of common spend. As in, every construction that happens needs to have parking spaces for residential buildings or for commercial buildings, et cetera. So everybody's bearing the cost because those parking spaces are expensive to build, especially if they're underground, which is true for city centers. So you transform cities from potentially being high density and walkable to being low density and unwalkable, and this kind of creates the common fabric of most American cities, especially the ones that are newer. And so you've got this kind of whole pattern that exists that's kind of slave to cars, can't really transform out of it, and is leading to, you know, a lot of challenges around, you can't really get it to have higher throughput, so you got traffic and congestion, because people don't want more congestion, they don't want more construction, so the cost of housing has created an affordability crisis in most cities. So you've got this like additional challenge where cities are kind of maxed out in some ways. And then you've obviously got this like extremely hostile environment to anybody who's a pedestrian or a vulnerable road user, like a bicyclist, and therefore like way higher road fatalities, like off the charts higher than most other countries with similar kind of GDP per capita, et cetera. So that's, you know, kind of the view as to like why the current system isn't great. I think when you point this out, I think people can be a little bit resistant, because I think there are a whole lot of other things about the system that are convenient and good. And if you're not failing within the system, you're quite reticent to see it disrupted or replaced. I think my most kind of pointed critique is that it's a fundamentally un-American system in that it doesn't allow choice. It basically creates a requirement that everybody follow the same system through heavy government subsidization, which I think Americans would very critically call socialism. And basically, you've got the socialist structure in which parking spaces are mandated by city governments for the most part. People have no choice but to own a car and then are locked into the system. To some extent, it's been rebranded as freedom, and people think that cars give them freedom, but I think the reality is kind of the opposite. So that's my, like, you know, punchy critique of why cars aren't great, especially in America, and why we should consider other alternatives. What's happened, and where a lot of my investing is focused, is you've had a massive transformation in the business model adjacent to car ownership. So I'd call this like a car ownership economy. And transit is like a counterpoint. All the assets are shared. You need density. You've got trains, et cetera, tracks that are built mostly by the government, and then people use these services and pay a fare for each individual trip. What's happened, you know, over the last decade or so, you've had the rise of companies like Uber and DoorDash and Instacart, and also Amazon, I think, is a company like this, even though it's not as obvious to people. And I call these companies trip economy companies, as in they offer trips. There are two kinds of trips. There's a trip that moves you, and there's a trip that moves something to you, a good of some kind. And so DoorDash is bringing you hot food, and Amazon's bringing you packages, and Uber's taking you to your meetings or out to the bar or something like that. And so these transportation marketplaces, these trip economy services, I think are fundamentally more efficient, as in they allow consumers to, on a trip-by-trip basis, to purchase the trip that they need, and cause the companies that are competing for that that trip to much more efficiently manufacture their vehicles to allow these services. So DoorDash is running e-bikes, especially in densities like New York, rather than, you know, using a much heavier and bigger vehicle. And you see this throughout the trip economy. Uber is transitioning to EVs much faster than the general population is, because those vehicles are super high utilization, and so they're looking to squeeze down costs. And Priuses as hybrids or full EVs, you're seeing more and more Teslas in these fleets, are also much more efficient. So you get this effect from the trip economy of greater efficiency and more convenience for customers. And so I think in many ways this is better, but it's also really hard to scale it in the US because car ownership is so dominant and so heavily subsidized.
And I guess just real quick, I'm one of those last, so you mentioned EVs are a good application because they're highly utilized, right? And that's because in the trade-off or the ROI decision, EVs are cheaper to operate, but they're more expensive up front. So if you're operating them a lot, then it makes sense to buy one.
Yes. If you look at China, for instance, where EVs have really grown initially, before Tesla launched in a big way in China, it was almost all fleet sales. It was ride-hailing services like Didi and other kinds of fleets that initially drove the adoption, because fleets are much more what you call TCO, total cost of ownership, sensitive. And so if you get the total cost of ownership, as in you add the marginal cost and the upfront costs over like a lifetime calculus, and you can see a benefit to the EVs, you'll see that transition soon. Also in the US, EV buses transitioned way sooner than most others because they're used in this kind of shared way with short trips and where the TCO was very compelling. So yeah, you'll see these TCO calculations really drive EV adoption, and the trip economy amplifies that in a very meaningful way, because the whole point is to drive increased asset utilization within a transportation marketplace, which is almost the opposite of an ownership economy, where the whole convenience of buying a car is that it waits around for you for whenever you need it. But most of the time, like 96% of the time, it's just occupying some piece of real estate and, you know, rusting and dripping metals, liquids onto the concrete, etc.
Yeah, I mean, That's interesting. And then go back to your critique of the lack of freedom caused by the existing infrastructure. So this is something, yeah, and I think you alluded to, we've talked about this previously, and something that I struggle with kind of at a core level when I think about my own decisions so far. So like, I don't know, I live in a suburban area partly because of vehicle safety, and I want my kids, I have a young kid right now, a second one coming, I want to have a place for them to run around that's safe. And I realize that pedestrian deaths are a leading cause of death for kids. So like, that's a piece of the puzzle. I don't work close to my house. It's like an hour highway drive. I can convince myself it's for a good reason, because like, I don't think I can, this job that I get to do is not available anywhere else, and the people that I get to work with are in that area. I live in this area for a specific reason, for various factors. And so I've tried the one vehicle thing. I've tried one vehicle with trying to use more shared mobility stuff. It didn't necessarily, the trade-offs that I was making didn't, like the fact that once my wife was unable to get an Uber to her work, and it just exploded our whole day, like that's not worth whatever a few hundred bucks I spend on a car per month for me. And so when I look at it, like when I critique myself from a green optimized perspective, I'm leaning towards a bigger SUV, because I want my family to be safe on the road. I also realize that that's the worst car to be driving, because that's a heavier than needed vehicle that I'm going to be driving and negatively contributing to the system. And so you could listen to that and critique and sound like excuses, which I think there's an aspect of it, but there's also an aspect of like, I'm making these decisions that don't feel right to me, because when I look at the system and I try to optimize for what's best for my family and myself, like I'm kind of forced into specific decisions. Is that kind of what you mean by that?
Yeah, and this is why I compare it to obesity, because a lot of people, I think, look at people who are overweight or obese and say, oh, it's, you know, it just requires, you know, strength of will. You just need to want it enough. You need to exercise, etc. But in America, it's really hard to make other choices, especially if you don't live in like New York City or LA. A lot of the food supply and the way in which every decision you make is structured actually pushes you towards certain kinds of foods that are kind of this mix of sugar and fat that's kind of addictive. And then you kind of create the cycle of dependency. This is what's so interesting about the conversation about Ozempic and Wegovy, these kinds of drugs, because they kind of shine this light on the fact that unless you have certain kinds of drugs coming into the system, people really struggle to make other decisions. And the only other kind of solution is to change the structure of incentives in the system, which is why I point to the kind of socialized way in which the whole system is set up. And I think you can make similar critiques about farm subsidies and capture, et cetera, within the food supply industry. Like, you've got all these snack companies and food companies that have incentives to maintain and fast, you know, quick service restaurants, et cetera. But I think you've got a similar set of structured incentives in the US around transportation. And once you're in this kind of system, it's hard to imagine something else. But you go to Europe and you see a very different kind of system, both on the food supply side and on the transportation supply side. And it should be clear that something better is possible, even before you get to the kind of Wegovy, Ozempic solution of autonomous vehicles, which can maybe magically fix a lot of these things.
Yeah. And so thinking about then, I mean, it feels like there's something close to a playbook. If we could start over, if you were building a new city, I think the information's there. If you go and search for it, like you can figure out how to do that in a pretty effective way. And I don't have any that come to mind, but I imagine there's good examples throughout that globally of system. Maybe let's stop there for now. Like, where is this being done from the ground floor well right now? Do you have any thoughts that come to mind?
Yeah, so there are a few different things that you could point to. There's things like the city called Cul-de-Sac. I think it's in Arizona, which is like a planned city. There are a few projects like this. There have been some things over the years in Florida, retirement communities that are constructed in a different way, with golf carts, etc. I think you, outside of, you know, like the suburbs, where it's more like a planned community, you've got different structures that are set up. You definitely have in Europe cities like Paris that are transforming themselves into being much more pedestrian focused. So you don't need to build from the ground up. And I think it's very hard actually to build a city from the ground up. Like you look at Saudi Arabia and the plan for NEOM, like that's a big plan, but it's also tough to execute. And it's not clear that necessarily all those systems make sense. There's something very organic about how a community grows and how a city grows that's very, very hard to pre-plan and organize. My friend Alain Botard has written a book called Order Without Design, and I think that that title really captures very much with checking out how the city planning process can't be too planned, I think, if you want to have something that's organic and vibrant. Mm. But you're seeing across Europe a very serious focus on transition. You see in the Netherlands, for instance, on the one hand, Amsterdam is what people like to point to, but Rotterdam was bombed out during the war by the Nazis, and so it was very much rebuilt as a car-centric city, and then was transformed back into being mobility, micro-mobility focused, bicycle-centric, etc. I think the challenge in the U.S. is that for the most part, American decision makers and planners see America as an entity unto itself, and are not super keen to like go to the Netherlands and be like, oh, how can we learn from this model? But for the most part, things are done in a very American way that fails to learn, I think, a lot of these lessons. You see this very much on the transit side, where the cost of building transit in the U.S. is disproportionately high, like 9 times higher than other countries with similar comps. Spain built a whole metro system for the cost of single lines in cities like New York and San Francisco. So I think there's a lot of learning that can be done, but there also has to be a recognition that the current system isn't great and that we could, you know, aim towards something better. So that's, you know, that's just on the planning side. I think the other way of looking or answering the question about what's being done and what's kind of exciting in terms of experimentation, the trip economy that I described is hard to implement even in Europe and definitely in the United States, because you have high rates of car ownership. And so all the decisions you described, the whole world's already been built around them, and you're just a marginal person making that decision. If you're living in Nairobi or in Delhi or in many of these fast-growing emerging market cities, also with high population growth, you've just got a very different situation that's playing out, because nobody owns cars yet. And the trip economy is, for the most part, the default solution. If you look at China, for instance, compared to the US and what Meituan, the main food delivery company there, does compared to DoorDash, you know, you've got 10% of the population basically ordering through Meituan every single day. Like the scale of the demand, and then many other people are ordering a few times a week, or, you know, at least once a week. So half the country, or half a billion people are using Meituan, and it's not the only vendor. So you've just got a different scale of trip economy, different scale of e-commerce rollout, different scale of ride-hailing services, and different costs, because you have much greater density. And so you're seeing different business models evolving in these marketplaces, and a new way to kind of develop. And the analogy here is the transition from, you know, from landlines to cellular is something that, you know, Europe and US, et cetera, needed to move through. But, you know, Africa or India just kind of leapfrogged a lot of this and went straight to smartphones, and even skipped laptop computers or computers themselves, and went straight to smartphone as the main computing device that people carry. So through that, you kind of see an analogy for how transportation can also be leapfrogged, and how you can have different solutions come in and different possibilities created that are quite exciting.
Yeah, there's a freedom that comes with not having inertia in an existing system, for sure. One question, I guess, about the trip economy. So there's kind of overly simplistic initial kind of fear or critique comes up of, well, is that efficient if 10% of the population, right, is ordering their food? Like, is that a more efficient system than having food shipped to a central place and then people making weekly trips or whatever? And I have a hard time. I've heard various sides of a story of, like, one kind of the naysayers say, well, you got people, you know, Ubers that are circling around and wasting time and adding to congestion. The other skeptical side of me says, well, like, that's a anyone who's optimizing their system is going to drive that out pretty quickly. And you're not going to have just a, like, if whoever's providing this service is incentivized to have as efficient as a simple as service as possible, because that they pay for any inefficiencies. Do you have a feel for like how efficient or how efficient from a congestion as well as resource utilization, energy utilization perspective, a more trip economy can be compared to kind of the existing setup?
Yeah, so I think this sounds really negative, but I think people really hate change. They really hate new things. Even if those things are better, they're very skeptical that the new thing is going to be better. And they look for all the reasons to criticize it and all the things they're going to lose because of this new system. And meanwhile, the existing system, they're totally chill with, because it's kind of like a sunk cost. They're already aware of all the things that it involves. Their life is built around it. And so they can't imagine that, you know, is going to be so bad. Whereas this new thing threatens, you know, the current system. You see this with scooters, you know, like the reactions people had to like scooters lying on the sidewalk. Like, they don't care that 80% of the space around them is dedicated to cars, most of which are parked, hideously ugly, taking up tons of space. And like, you know, the rest of the road space is like totally intolerant of people. Like, you can't step on it for very long or you'll be driven over. But scooters are dangerous, and scooters, you know, even though like the reason people get injured on scooters is because they're getting hit by cars. So I think you're seeing a lot of those kinds of dynamics. Uber causing traffic increases, emissions increases. You saw tons of reports from well-meaning academics trying to point out these kinds of things. And you think you're working with a natural bias that people just don't like change and don't like innovation and will resist it. But we're comparing a subscale system to a scaled system, and then we're like really cherry picking our examples in order to try and find the inefficiencies, because there's a kind of search algorithm that's looking for the problems rather than like kind of optimistic about the solutions. And I don't want to like divorce from reality and be like, oh, you know, be like techno optimistic in a way that's delusional, which I think is sometimes the way investors talk about the world. But the alternative to, you know, getting your restaurant food delivered, which is often on a motorbike or bicycle, and often involves bundling and, you know, a certain kind of matching of a courier that is nearby to that restaurant and then comes to you and then goes to another restaurant that's also nearby, is for you to get into your car that's parked on a piece of real estate that it's occupying, that it doesn't pay fair rent on. Drive to that store in the car that has, you know, four other empty seats and an empty trunk, and then, you know, park somewhere around that store where you have more real estate dedicated to parking that could have been used for other things. Being, you know, it's an invisible cost, but that's also being borne by society. Pick up your food and then drive all the way back again. Like, there's no comparison. Like, the one is clearly less efficient than the other, and as you scale it, there are all sorts of other things, like the transition to EVs or smaller vehicles or bundling that get better. I think on top of that, there's an extra benefit to the trip economy, which is all these negative externalities that you might point to that you might not like. Like, say they insist on using gas-powered scooters rather than electric scooters. Well, there's ways in which you can create incentives in trip pricing for people to make choices for better outcomes, and for regulators to kind of put their finger on the scale and encourage a certain kind of transition just by adding certain costs to the trip price, which is just not possible in the car ownership economy. So you also have way more tools on the regulatory side. Not that you necessarily want to use them willy-nilly, but you do have this possibility for externalities to be much better priced into a trip price marketplace than in an ownership economy where you spend, I don't know, $40,000 on a vehicle up front, and then you never think about the marginal costs.
Yeah, and I think maybe that expanding on that example you gave, like, that's also a much better place to incentivize than incentivizing someone's pickup with a 200 kilowatt hour pack that they're going to go and buy and park for 95% of the time, and then also introduce a bunch of extra weight on the road and safety hazard and stuff. Like, it seems like a lot of places the current EV incentives are going towards making the system worse in some ways, as opposed to something like this, where like, no, it actually does make sense that you have an electric scooter or bike or whatever that's picking up this thing, and it is being utilized very heavily, and like that is the optimal vehicle for that thing. So you can actually make sure that your incentive is going to something that's making a difference.
Yeah, I mean, given this comparison to the food value chain and obesity, you won't be surprised to hear that I compare, you know, that problem to car obesity in the United States, where cars have gotten bigger and bigger because they don't, you know, pay the full cost of the negative externalities that they create. Like, big cars kill people at much higher rates because you can't see over the bonnet, and because when you have a collision, you know, it's much more fatal if the vehicle's big. But that price is not accounted for or subsumed in. And as far as I can tell, you know, the electric vehicle incentives so far have only amplified the obesity crisis for American cars. The Hummer EV is the most grotesque example of this, where it's just this enormous vehicle with an enormous weight that has just like tons of batteries that could be used for e-bikes or all sorts of other things, like, you know, close to 100 of them, just sitting in its belly and, you know, being underutilized most of the time. So I think you're right. Like, even though Elon Musk kind of has painted this vision of like, this is the future we want to be aiming for, where like we basically have the whole system recreated, but suddenly colored green and we don't have to feel guilty about it, I think we're really missing the opportunity to aim towards a much better system that's much, much more fundamentally efficient, rather than we just substitute one thing that we feel bad about with something we feel better about.
Yeah, and how, so you, someone listening to this might be thinking kind of from a pessimistic mood, right? Like, well, there's a lot of challenges, the system's not optimal in a lot of ways, there's hidden costs and some things that you've uncovered, right? In several different aspects, there's challenges, the change, we didn't even get into the in too much detail, the difficulty of transit projects in the U.S. and the complexity of all the different players and incentive structure and everything that goes into actually making changes, and tons of headwinds, and to actually make change towards this future, which is could be much better than it currently is. Like, I mean, it's not optimal, but anyone who even spent a week in one of these European cities where you're able to walk and ride a bike and experience, like, it's a, not just from a vacation perspective, but it's a very pleasant, safe, positive experience that you can feel going through that. And so, like, there is a better future out there, but it's not easy to get there. And so the question I guess I would have is, and maybe this is tied in because you are putting your money where your mouth is in the investment space, like, how do you think about where are the players in the system who can actually make a meaningful, positive impact despite all these headwinds that we're facing? Like, where should we be focusing our efforts?
Yeah, I think it's important to get a little bit angry about how bad the system is in order to be motivated to make it better. I think a huge failure is on the regulation side. Like, we need to remove parking minimums and all the other incentives that make it just inevitable that people own cars and don't, you know, create a more rational market for this. Basically, like, the socialism of car ownership should be, you know, reversed, and the true cost to society should be borne by those who benefit from them. And, like, I'm definitely not against cars. I think, you know, America has a lot of space and benefits a lot from cars. And if you go to Europe, you know, there isn't a country in Europe, I mean, there's probably like small places like Monaco or something like that, but they don't have cars, you know, filling a massively important function within their transportation networks. But I think cars have been so heavily subsidized that it's not possible to offer better solutions in a whole bunch of cities and areas around cities, etc. And so just leveling the playing field seems the first step to having better outcomes. That said, you know, I'm not a policymaker, and I talk to policymakers and, you know, speak my mind in general because I don't have such a great filter. And I think people generally appreciate it. But I don't see this stuff necessarily transforming super quickly without a lot of people getting motivated to push, you know, this kind of agenda. And it's kind of education and shift that takes time. I wrote a book in part to like point out a perspective for thinking about it, a framework for thinking about it. And there are many other people in different ways that are recognizing this problem, seeing that it's a big issue, getting more organized and motivated to bring about certain kinds of transformations. but it's the kind of work that takes time. The other thing that's happening, and also which I'm involved in, is that there are founders that are creating companies that attack this problem. And I think it's not super obvious what the best solutions are. And a bunch of them, like I think scooter sharing is actually quite efficient and quite beneficial to society, even though it's been relatively unsuccessful because the headwinds have been quite extreme. Take, for example, that in many cities for a scooter, you have to park it in a specially designated zone. But a car you can park in many places in between all those specially designated zones. So your value proposition to consumers is like, hey, take this vehicle that has almost zero emissions, super lightweight, you know, very low cost to damaging roads and infrastructure, and have a shitty experience, please, because we're not going to let you use the same space that these cars that kill people and pollute a lot and have massive costs to society use. That's basically like how I understand it. But it's not how people intuit it because they're used to the one system and kind of wary of the new system. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot of ways in which technology is chipping away at the edges and bringing about alternatives. And there's like a whole world of solutions now, mobility services that have become verbs in people's lives, like Ubering, that I think do point a way to alternatives that are better. And then you've got new technologies like autonomy that very dramatically reduce the cost of services like ride hailing or delivery, and then make it more viable to move towards a trip economy. If you have low cost and high scale autonomous system, like say Waymo starts scaling up to every American city over the next 2 years, I think you could see really dramatic transformation, especially when you get to the point where, you know, they're basically able to serve all trips in a central core of a city. And it's like, do we really need, you know, people driving around in these centers? Do we need the same vehicle form factors? Or can we have slightly different vehicles that are all electric and that are, you know, built to size, right-sized for their particular use case? If you were to transition, I don't want to be like too dogmatic about like how quickly and in what way, but you probably wouldn't have many pedestrian fatalities if all the vehicles were autonomous beyond a certain point. Like we get really upset with every, you know, incident that happens with an autonomous vehicle. But I think it's very hard to believe that it's not going to be a much safer system at scale in the long run.
Yeah, I think a lot there, and I agree. One note, I don't know if this will go anywhere, but I have a note that you believe it's you don't want to be a maximalist in this situation. If that rings a bell, can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, I think there's a danger. I mean, I use this term like socialism in a provocative way because I think a lot of Americans who are more conservative or would call themselves conservative are very, you know, against government interference, but quite tolerant of the government forcing everybody to have cars. But I don't want to like take the opposite position, which is what I'm describing as maximalist, which I think a lot of people on the left take, which is like, to be radically against, you know, this whole system and to be very threatening, I think, to, you know, normal folks who make rational and reasonable decisions around using cars. I think most people are using cars because it makes sense and it's actually quite a good system. And they also don't, you know, mean to cause bad social outcomes like accidents or, you know, have dangerous vehicles like SUVs for any other reason they're looking out for their own families and trying to protect them. So I don't want to like jump out and be like, you know, we need to stop people driving cars in city centers. Like we need to ban it. We need to ban cars everywhere. You know, I think this is some of the language you see, like war against cars and stuff like that. And I think it's tricky because I think America often like gets into these identity wars. Things get polarized. It's a two-party system. And so you're either for or against on most issues and they kind of get split this way. But I think what I'm actually looking for is just better social outcomes for everybody. And there are not that many problems in the world where there's such simple and clear solutions. But this is one of them in which you can create a much better system for everybody and nobody has to suffer dramatically in order to get there. A lot of other areas involve meaningful trade-off decisions where one group needs to be prioritized over another. But this is something that can actually improve outcomes for, you know, most people. Without causing that much cost to people. Like just take fatalities, like 40,000 people dying every year. That's just like really bad for America.
Yeah, it's crazy that we accept it. Right.
I think there are the things that people get outraged by, and then some things that people shrug their shoulders at, like the amount of people that will die in America from car crashes who are young and productive is less than the number of people that have died in Gaza. I mean, obviously big differences between those two issues, but one of them brings massive protests onto the street and the other one rarely is even recognized. If you ask the average American, like, how many Americans die in car crashes, they don't know and they don't care. And I think that's a travesty.
And it's more than in Gaza, right?
Yeah, it's more than in Gaza. I mean, it's 25,000 people so far, according
to... I think last question, and then we wrap up. So with all of this said, I imagine you had a driven, smart college student who comes up to you and asks for advice. You know, they hear you talk, they're like, hey, I'm mad about this system being suboptimal. What do I do? What type of advice do you typically give?
Well, I think it's hard to be like, this is like the one thing to work on. I think if you want to go into policy, there are lots of things to be done on the policy side. And I know of great people who've done work on that side and have, you know, a great potential impact. It will take time. Part of it's like, you know, having constructive conversations at the Thanksgiving dinner table or talking to your friends or, you know, how you vote and engage. Sometimes it can be around building a company. I think this is why I like the idea of like writing a book that's more a framework, because I think it's easy to be like, this is the solution or this needs to happen, but it's like a big problem and it's not easy to unravel. I think America is a wonderful country and extremely successful and, you know, economically immensely powerful. And so all the easy problems have mostly been solved. The reasons there are big problems with things like healthcare and, you know, the food system or with education and also with transportation is not because like somebody didn't figure out the obvious solution. It's that there are a whole lot of complicated social factors that are playing against each other. And it takes quite a lot of focus and effort and a certain kind of discipline and goodwill and citizenship in order to get to better outcomes. But I think what I think is the first step and the most important thing is to recognize that the system isn't good. And I think there's often a danger I see when I talk to Americans where they're just like, greatest country on earth, which is true in some ways. Like, it's just so like the network effects of the economy are so strong. But it's also like blinding. If you think you're the best in everything, you're not going to look to other examples where some things are better and learn from them and bring those learnings back.
Yeah, and I mean, even if you do come to the conclusion that America is the greatest country on earth, it'd be ridiculous to think that that means that they are the greatest, or we're the greatest country on earth on every single aspect of what it means to be a country and a place of living, right? And I think transportation pretty clearly is one in which we are not leading in the areas where we'd like to be. So, this has been a lot of fun. I mean, I'll link to the book in the show notes here. I recommend it for anyone listening to this if you want to learn more. I think, like I said, the data you present, the way you present it, and this is a topic that I've been trying to unpack now for coming on 4 years and 200 episodes of the podcast here, and you. Several places have connected dots and made incremental improvements for me, and maybe even some drastic improvements in understanding. And so really appreciate that work, you coming on here and exploring some of these things. Maybe last thing, was there anything we missed that you were hoping to cover here?
I was just going to say, you can also read the book online for free. It's published. The URL is yellow, like the color yellow.cab. So if you type that in, it will just pull up the book. And it's all there. And also, I mean, it sounds a little bit dry that it's called Mobility Disruption Framework, but it's got lots of great pictures in it of cats and dogs. If you don't like the content, hopefully you'll at least like the pictures because they're quite cute.
And I'll make sure to add that in the intro too, of like, yeah, this is not that you wrote this book to make money on a book and that we're trying to pitch your book this whole time. This is no, you have ideas that you're trying to share with the world here that are packaged well. And yeah, it is an entertaining read. I appreciate that.
Great. I appreciate your time, and it was great to talk to you.
Thanks, Olaf. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Oh, there you have it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Olaf Soccer. So what stands out? One, I like the analogy, right, of the purpose of transportation. It's like blood in the human body. It moves you from place to place, experience to experience, right? And also Olaf broke down the way in which the U.S. transportation ecosystem is really underperforming and the impact of that, right? And that there's this illusion, and that it's typically said that cars give you freedom. The ownership of cars, part of the American dream, right? The ability to get in the car and go anywhere, which there is some truth to that, but also there are negative externalities. There are also a limiting factor in the potential solution set for how you can get to the experiences and the things that mean the most in your life if you live in a society that has been so heavily optimized for the personal vehicle, personal car as the way of transportation. So kind of opening the eyes to that and starting to think about, okay, what should we be looking at to make improvements? And he highlighted a few things, such as removing parking minimums, putting some incentive structure in place to enable and also encourage people to make better choices that serve themselves and others in a more positive way, and then also kind of on a longer scale, this transition to automation. So really, really fun discussion. I really enjoy these philosophical conversations because I'm still trying to get to this question of, okay, what are we actually trying to do here? So yes, there's a lot of great work, and we continue to do good work in the tactics and even some of the strategies of how we can improve means of transportation, the way in which we're moving people from A to B and getting access to things. But we still need to better understand and also communicate this question of, what are we actually trying to do? What role does mobility, does transportation play in our lives? Because only once we truly understand that can we make sure that we're working on the things that make the biggest impact. So that's what I came into this conversation hoping to unpack a bit. I think Olaf did an excellent job explaining some of these things, and I certainly walked away with, I feel like, more knowledge and also more questions about where to go from here. So really enjoy you listening. As always, there's more to come next week.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Mobility Podcast.